This is your weekly checkup with Howard Feldman and Dr. Anton Myberg, where medical innovation meets human understanding.
A very good evening and welcome to the weekly checkup with me, Howard Feldman, and Dr. Anton Myberg. Tonight's show could quite literally save your life because we're talking about strokes and heart attacks, conditions that often come without warning, but where minutes can mean the difference between life and death or permanent damage. So what are the warning signs? What should we do in that moment? And most importantly, how do we reduce the risk before something happens? Anton Myberg, a very good evening. Hope you're well.
Good evening, Howard. Nice to be back. We've had a bit of an interlude, but a very serious subject tonight.
So it really is. If we can just maybe start with the basics. In simple English, what is a heart attack?
So as put as basically as possible, a heart attack is a circulation problem. This happens when the blood supply is part of the heart muscle that is actually blocked. It becomes blocked very suddenly. And if you think of the heart as a pump that needs fuel or oxygen-rich blood to work, the fuel travels through the small pipes called your coronary arteries, and a heart attack occurs when one of these pipes gets clogged up. And that's usually due to a buildup of fat or cholesterol, which we call plaque, that eventually forms a blood clot. So when the blood can't get through, that part of the heart muscle begins to starve and die from a lack of oxygen, which becomes a medical emergency. The longer this blockage lasts, the more permanent the damage. And a lot of people can't discern the difference between a heart attack and a cardiac arrest. For simplicity's sake, you must look at a heart attack as a plumbing problem. There's a blocked blood flow where the heart usually keeps beating during attack, whereas a cardiac arrest is an electrical problem and the heart suddenly malfunctions and stops beating entirely.
Okay, so if somebody has a heart attack, does that mean they've always going to have that blockage, which means a stent or something like that?
Not necessarily. There are different types of heart attacks. It could be a silent heart attack. There could be a mild heart attack. I think we need to go into more the pathophysiology and understanding what a heart attack is caused by.
Okay, and a stroke?
So the simplistic way to explain a stroke is a brain attack. That happens when your blood supply to part of your brain is suddenly cut off and or reduced, and that stops your brain cells from getting oxygen and nutrients that they need to stay alive. In essence, you can think of it like a heart attack, but in the brain. Within minutes, the brain cells begin to die, and this can lead to permanent damage or disability. And there are two ways that this happens, either through a blockage, which we call an ischemic stroke, or a bleed, which is called a hemorrhagic stroke. The ischemic stroke is the most common type, about 89% of the causes. That happens with a blood clot or a buildup of fatty deposits. The plaque blocks an artery leading to the brain. And the bleed is the hemorrhagic stroke, is when a blood vessel in the brain breaks or leaks. And that leaking blood puts too much pressure on the brain cells and damages them.
Okay, so that's what I actually, it's so funny because like I feel like I know the basics, but I actually didn't know that. I didn't know that there are two types of strokes because sometimes you hear people say that a stroke and a bleed on the brain, and sometimes it's a clot. So,
and it's very important because it helps you understand the different types of treatment that you need down the line.
Okay, what are the causes of a stroke and versus a heart attack?
So a heart attack, or as people know it, as a myocardial infarction, that occurs, as we said, when blood flow carrying oxygen to the heart muscle is severely reduced or blocked. And it's usually by a clot forming on a ruptured plaque in the coronary arteries. And this blockage causes the heart muscles and the cells inside it to become damaged or die. The primary or main causes and mechanisms include coronary artery disease. That's where plaque or fat or cholesterol builds up in arteries, narrowing them over time. Or it can be due to a plaque rupture, blood clot, where a plaque ruptures and that triggers the body to form a clot, which completely or partially blocks the artery. Another cause is a coronary artery spasm, where there's a severe contraction of a blood vessel that stops blood flow. And that can even happen without severe atherosclerosis, without that fatty deposit. And a further one is a spontaneous coronary artery dissection, where there's a tear inside the artery which causes blockage. And your major risk factors for these things are smoking, vaping, unhealthy diet, high cholesterol, high blood pressure, diabetes, old age, and family history.
Okay, I want to come back.
That's just for heart attack, but I think for stroke, there's other different causes. We said, remember, we said a stroke is also a medical emergency, and that occurs when your blood flow to the brain is interrupted, where you get a deprivation of brain cells of the oxygen and the nutrients they need to survive. And there are two types or primary mechanisms involved. This, the one is ischemic stroke, And that could be a thrombotic stroke or embolic stroke. So remember, the ischemic stroke is your blockage, which is your most common. The thrombotic stroke in that is a blood clot or a thrombus, as we call it, forms directly in the brain artery. And that's often due to atherosclerosis or a buildup of the fat or the fatty cloth. And the other type is the embolic stroke under that. And that's where a clot forms somewhere else in the body, frequently the heart, when someone's got something like underlying, like atrial fibrillation. And that travels through the bloodstream until it lodges in a narrow brain artery. And then the second type of blockage, as we said, was the hemorrhagic stroke, and that's bleeding. And that can be when a blood vessel in the brain leaks or ruptures. And there are two subtypes of that. The one is intracerebral hemorrhage, where bleeding occurs directly into the brain tissue, often due to high blood pressure, or subarachnoid hemorrhage, where bleeding occurs in the space between the brain and the surrounding membranes. And that can be caused by a brain aneurysm, which is a weak spot in the brain vessels that spurts, or an AVM, arteriovenous malformation, which is a tangle of abnormal blood vessels. And your risk factors are very similar to that of a heart attack, which is high blood pressure, atrial fibrillation, smoking, alcohol, increased cholesterol, diabetes, consistent with both diseases.
So it could that type of stroke be caused by a brain injury, for example?
So it could be. Remember, we've discussed that there's intracerebral and there's subdural. So typically with a brain injury, if someone falls into the head, there's a higher chance of getting that subdural bleed. And if it puts pressure on the brain and it narrows the area of the brain to work in, there's a higher chance of having a stroke.
Okay. So, and why would they both be time critical, strokes and heart attacks?
Well, they both involve a sudden interruption of blood flow to a vital organ, which is either your brain or your heart. And that starves your cells of your necessary oxygen and your nutrients. And once these cells are deprived of the oxygen, they start to die. So with a heart attack, the blockage of a coronary artery stops the blood from going to the heart, and the heart muscle can start dying within as little as 20 to 30 minutes without oxygen. Whereas the brain, with a stroke, a blockage or a burst vessel stops blood from reaching the brain. And during a stroke, they estimate there's about 2 million brain cells are lost every minute. So your primary goal in both of these emergencies is to restore your blood flow as quickly as possible to save as much tissue as possible. And you need to minimize permanent damage, because the problem with the brain and the heart is neither of these organs can regenerate their cells. So once these cells die, the damage is permanent. And rapid treatment can help with this, with help with limiting the area of the tissue death, potentially preventing the heart and the brain from having long life disabilities, like things like paralysis, speech loss, or enlargement of the heart. And there's certain things that are time sensitive in the treatment with regards to certain life-saving treatments, clot-busting drugs, for example. They're necessary to be administered within a few hours to help with these type of things.
This is your weekly checkup with me, Howard Feldman, and Dr. Anton Myberg. This evening, we are speaking about heart attacks and strokes. Before we move on to talk about symptoms, just a quick question going back to the general nature of both strokes and heart attacks. Are they actually, we're speaking about them in the same podcast, same subject. Do the same people tend to suffer from both?
So it's a good question, because they are both types of cardiovascular disease, and therefore they both share some of the underlying similar causes. And they affect the same type of people, because people tend to get both is because they share common biological processes, which is a process called atherosclerosis, which is a buildup of that fatty plaque in the arteries. And there's a shared root cause where your plaque buildup can occur anywhere in the body. So if it blocks blood flow to the heart, can cause a heart attack. If it causes a blockage of blood flow to the brain, can cause an ischemic stroke. And as we mentioned earlier, the common risk factors are high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes, obesity, smoking, vaping, and physical inactivity. And there's a direct link between the two. So even though they've got shared risks, one event can definitely trigger the other. A heart attack can lead to a stroke. So a heart attack can damage the muscle of the heart, which then can cause a rhythm problem, such as a condition called atrial fibrillation. And this can lead to blood clots forming in the heart, which can break off and travel into the brain. There's an increased risk post-event of a stroke that in the first 3 months following a heart attack, there's a much higher risk. You're more like 32 times more prone to having an ischemic stroke in those who haven't had one, who've had a heart attack. So strokes can lead to heart problems as well, although it's much more rare.
Okay, so that It gives us a very good general picture of what a stroke is and what a heart attack is. Let's now start to talk about the classic symptoms, because I would imagine, and let's start off with talking about strokes, I imagine that there are more obvious symptoms as well as more subtle symptoms. Can you go through those?
So the classic symptoms of a stroke are characterized by their sudden onset, and we often use a mnemonic to remember them called BEFAST, BEFAST. The B standing for balance, because you get a sudden loss of balance or dizziness or trouble walking. The E stands for eyes, where you get blurred eyes, double vision, or loss of vision on one or both eyes. F is for face, where you get an asymmetry, one side of the face droops or feels numb. And when you ask a person to smile, they smile, which can be uneven. Now, it doesn't mean if you've got one of these things, you're having a stroke. There's got to be a sort of a combination of a few things to say that, because, I mean, you can have something called a Bell's palsy, which is a weakness on the one side of the face. That doesn't mean you're having a stroke. The A is for arms, where you get sudden weakness or numbness in one arm. When you're trying to raise both arms, one may drift downwards. The S is for speech, where the speech becomes slurred, garbled, or you get a difficulty in understanding the person. And T is for time, is that if any of the signs are present, you have to act immediately and note when the symptoms started. Other warning signs are sudden severe headache. Someone calls it the worst headache of your life, a thunderclap headache, sudden confusion, or sudden numbness or weakness. And women actually experience classic symptoms mentioned that we mentioned now with less typical signs. And the signs are they get also nausea or vomiting, general weakness or fatigue, and shortness of breath or chest pain. So they sometimes have less significant symptoms than men, and these can also be missed.
Can these symptoms come and go?
So they definitely can come and go. The problem is that, first of all, these symptoms aren't always classic. So sometimes you do get the facial drooping. Sometimes you get the slurred speech. You can get visual balance and coordination in issues, etc. They can come and go because you can be waiting for the time for them to happen with a small sort of increment in the symptoms. So a person gets a small headache, and then they can have what we call a TIA. A TIA is a transient ischemic attack, which we call a mini stroke. And the mini stroke is when symptoms suddenly appear and then disappear. And that basically happens within a few minutes or a few hours. And the cause is a temporary blockage in one of the blood vessels or the blood flow to the brain. It normally lasts less than an hour, but can last up to 24 hours. The problem with it is that 1 in 5 people who have a TIA usually do have a stroke within 3 months. So you can get a fluctuation in your symptoms in full strokes as well, because the symptoms may occur gradually over hours and or days as clots form.
So the TIA, does that resolve itself generally?
Yeah, so TIA is a warning sign. It's like there's a big siren going off, and you've got to understand that something's happened. It's a transient or it's a temporary blockage of the vessel, because the vessel hasn't been fully blocked by a complete occlusion of a plaque. So it's only half blocked. And if there's spasm of the vessel, it blocks it completely, but then it relaxes. So that's why you get a transient.
So to some extent, a TIA is actually could be seen as a very positive thing. I mean, obviously it's not, but would it not be that it is a warning sign that you could deal with the symptom, you know, prevention of a bigger event?
Well, it's a warning sign only if you understand that you've had a TIA. It gives you an understanding to check your cholesterol, check your carotid vessels in your neck, have your heart checked out, check your risk factors, your life.
Right. Okay, got it. Let's talk about now the symptoms of a heart attack.
All heart attacks don't necessarily present with chest pain. I think that's very important. One out of three people who have a heart attack don't experience the chest pain that is common to everybody else. You can present with referred pain, which is a discomfort that spreads to your shoulders or to your jaw or to your arms or your back. A lot of people present with stomach issues, where they get symptoms that feel like indigestion or heartburn, physical weakness, sudden cold sweats, breathing trouble. I remember I had a patient who told me that early in the morning he had severe pain in his stomach. He took a proton pump inhibitor, which was something like Nexium. A few hours later, he took another one. The pain didn't abate. A few hours later, he took another one. And at that time, he didn't even realize he was having a heart attack. So these things can happen, but women are more likely to have no chest pain. So they often report an unusual fatigue, nausea, or shortness of breath. And especially in people who are diabetic, the high blood sugar damages nerves that carry pain signals from the heart. So that can mask the classic crushing of the chest pain. So the difference with women and why the symptoms differ is that women often experience heart attacks due to blockages in the smaller blood vessels. We call it microvascular disease, rather than just major arteries, which may not show up on a standard angiogram. They tend to have a higher pain threshold to men, and they generally attribute their symptoms to something else.
So when women say they're fine, this is really where it comes from.
That's actually
I'm
scrap.
fine. I'm really fine. No, you're not. You're
Okay.
busy having a heart attack. Okay. So in other words, so that really does answer one of my questions is do all heart attacks present with chest pains? No,
No.
actually. It's that which is incredible. And of course, I was going to ask about the difference between men and women. What are the most commonly ignored symptoms?
People generally mistake indigestion and heartburn or muscle strain as mild discomfort, and they don't fit the classic, what people describe as a clutching the chest type of pain. So the heartburn, indigestion, or aches in other areas, or unexplained fatigue or shortness of breath. These are things that are commonly ignored because when it's a mild presentation, people live in that busy life trap. So they push through the discomfort, soon it's just stress or lack of sleep, and go on with it. And as we said, women or diabetics have different experiences that with more subtle, atypical symptoms. So that's also really something that is an ignored symptom because they don't realize what they're going through.
What we want to talk about now is what to do in that moment. I've heard the expression a golden hour. Is that a real thing?
So there's no doubt it is a very real thing. The golden hour is essentially an hour in which you've got to treat this disease or this process because you need to act quickly and you need to act authoritatively so that you can get treatment on board.
Okay, so now let's talk about what to do if somebody suspects they are having a stroke.
So the first thing you should do is call your emergency services immediately. Don't wait to see if symptoms improve or go away, because as we said, every second counts to prevent brain damage or cardiac damage. So what's important for the bystander to notice is that if they're waiting for an ambulance, follow these critical steps. Identify the time the exact symptoms first appeared, because that's vital for doctors to determine which time-sensitive treatments, like clot-busting drugs, can be safely used. Stay with the person, keep them calm, keep them reassured. Make sure they don't get given food or drink because you don't get to choke. Okay? Specifically, do not give aspirin to someone who you think is having a stroke, because if it's a hemorrhagic stroke, a bleeding stroke, aspirin
It's
causes
going to make it
bleeding.
worse.
Okay? And obviously, don't drive them to the hospital. Let paramedics or emergency services handle that. Only time you give aspirin to a patient with a cardiac issue is when you've spoken to emergency personnel and they've told you rather give the aspirin now.
Boy, I feel kind of bad because many years ago, my father phoned me from the airport and he told me he had terrible shoulder pains and I could hear that his breathing wasn't great. And I said to him, reach into your bag. He had just landed. And I said, take an aspirin. But
And where is your father now?
well, it's not the point where he is now.
Yes.
He was fine after that. It turned out he
Yes.
was having a heart
Everyone's
attack.
a doctor. Yes.
All right, fine. Fine. Where's he now? That's a very, very rude question. So we shouldn't be driving ourselves to the hospital, is
No,
what you're
don't
saying.
drive yourself to hospital.
So the reality is that that's really what we're talking about with a stroke. Heart attack.
So heart attack, once again, call emergency services, very important. There's a term we use called the W position. So rest and stay calm. Put the patient in a sitting or lying down comfortable position. We call it the W position because you sit with your back supported and your knees bent, and this can help reduce the strain on the heart and make your breathing easier. Only take aspirin if it is advised you by a medical personnel. If you're not allergic and you have no medical reason not to, and then we say you must chew the aspirin because there's better absorption by chewing the aspirin. One adult aspirin of 325 milligrams or 2 to 4 low dose baby aspirins. We call them Ecotrin, 81 milligrams. So the chewing helps it enter your bloodstream faster to help thin the blood. Once again, you only take the aspirin if your emergency operator or your doctor has recommended it. There are other things that can be given, which is prescribed medication, such as nitroglycerin, which is a vasodilator, which is a spray that can be sprayed onto the tongue. And then also make the patient comfortable, loosen their clothing, unfasten any tight belts. If someone is having a heart attack and they lose consciousness, check their responsiveness, see if there's an AED, which is an automated external defibrillator around, if you know how to use one, and start CPR immediately. Do not leave them alone. And once again, do not offer them anything to eat or drink.
So the minute by minute stroke or heart attack, does it follow the same pattern with everybody, or is it can it follow a different sort of a pattern?
Stroke or heart attack, the body undergoes, as we said, a rapid and life-threatening cascade of cellular and physiological changes. In both cases, the root cause is ischemia, which is a blood loss, a sudden blood loss of blood that will deprive your vital tissue of oxygen and nutrients. And if we're looking at minute by minute, if you're looking at a stroke, which is a brain attack, in the first minute, there's immediate shutdown. The brain cells stop functioning within seconds as something called ATP, which is energy levels, plummet. Within 2 to 5 minutes, cell death begins. You get an irreversible structural damage starting in the core area of the brain, and you can roughly lose 2 million brain cells every 2 minutes. Within 5 to 10 minutes, you get systemic spread where your neurotransmitters like glutamate flood the brain, and this causes what we call an exocytotoxicity. That's an overstimulation that kills the neighboring healthy cells. And within 10 to 60 minutes, you mentioned earlier the golden hour, the brain or the heart enters a critical state where the tissue surrounding it is still salvageable with immediate medical intervention, and that's why you've got to get them to hospital. With regards to a heart attack, the first minute we get electrical instability. So the heart muscles begin to gasp for oxygen. The heart's electrical rhythm will become irregular, and you get what's called an arrhythmia. Within the next 2 to 5 minutes, you can get muscle damage. The affected heart muscle stops contracting properly, and if the heart stops entirely, the brain cells then begin to die within this window as well. Within 5 to 10 minutes, they present with severe symptoms of crushing chest pain or pressure, which typically lasts about 10 minutes. And then they might even get fluid backing up in their lungs, causing shortness of breath. And within that golden hour, you get the deprivation of the cells beginning to transition from a reversible injury to a permanent death, which is called necrosis of the cells. And the patient presents with cold sweats and nausea.
What percentage of people, I mean, when people have a heart attack, obviously it strikes fear into all of us, especially those of us that are starting to get a little bit more mature in years. What percentage of heart attacks are fatal, or fatal immediately?
You've got to look at how severe the heart attack and how long the delay is. Remember, in a heart attack, we say time is a muscle. So if you delay care, it leads to more extensive and permanent damage to the heart muscle. So for every 30-minute delay in treatment, your risk of death goes up by 7.5%. You can get heart failure, get a weakened heart, you get a reduced what we call ejection fraction, which is the contraction of the heart, where the heart struggles to pump blood. This can lead to chronic fatigue, shortness of breath. You get life-threatening arrhythmias. So, with regards to a question of how quickly it can happen, it depends on how severely the blood vessels are blocked, what other comorbidities or factors you've got relating to all of this.
Okay, and once you get to the hospital, if you get there in time, just to give a sense of the treatment that that a person is likely to receive.
So, if we're talking about emergency treatment for a stroke, this all falls under the golden hour once again. For the most common type of stroke, ischemic stroke, our goal is to restore blood flow to the brain as quickly as possible. So, we have medication called clot busting medication, which are called thrombolytics, and doctors can administer these intravenous medications with a substance called TPA, which is tissue plasminogen activator, to dissolve the clot. The time window is critical for this, because this must typically be given within 4.5 hours of when the symptoms first started. And that's why we say when somebody has a stroke, you've got to note the time of the stroke so we know how long it's happening in. There's other things you can do called a mechanical thrombectomy, which are for larger clots, where specialists can use a catheter to physically pull out the clot from the brain. And that procedure is often effective from about 6 to 24 hours after the initial symptoms. If someone's had a hemorrhagic stroke,
This freaks me out a bit because these two types of strokes will have exactly the opposite treatment, surely.
And that's the whole point of not giving aspirin. That's the whole
yes,
point.
Yes, no, I understand, but that's quite scary,
so that's
because
to get someone to a hospital.
They're both strokes, but one, you want more bleeding, really. You want to dissolve the clot, and the other one, you want to stop bleeding.
So hence why it's so important that when you go to the hospital, you have an MRI scan or a CT scan of your brain so you can ascertain what the cause is. So if you've got a hemorrhagic stroke, which is the bleeding rather than a
Yes,
clot,
yes.
then you're going to need surgery to repair those blood vessels and they insert coils or clips to stop the bleeding. With regards to a heart attack, the treatment's obviously very much different. As I said earlier, time is muscle, which is very, very important here, because the primary treatment is something called a primary PCR, which is a percutaneous intervention, which is called an angiogram, angioplasty, and then stenting. And that's your gold standard for many of your heart attacks, where a doctor threads a balloon through a blood vessel to widen the blocked artery and often can place a stent, which is a mesh tube, to re-expand that vessel. And the time window is most effective when it's performed within 1.5 hours of arriving at the hospital. The other treatments are what you call clot busting medication as well. And if your hospital doesn't have an angioplasty or angiogram suite, a cath lab we call it, then they may use these intravenous thrombolytic drugs to break up the heart clot. And immediately on arriving at the hospital, patients with heart attacks are generally given aspirin to prevent further clotting and nitroglycerin, which is a vasodilator, which improves blood flow and reduces chest pain.
Okay, so your stent, if you require one or more, would be administered preferably immediately.
Right. As soon as you've had your angiogram,
yes.
If there's a blockage that you're able to unblock with regards to
right.
The
stent. I'm Howard Feldman, talking about strokes and heart attacks. We've spoken about the time, the critical nature of it. We've spoken about what a stroke is, what a heart attack is. And now I'd like to try and focus a little bit on who is at risk. What do you see? In fact, that's where I would like to start. I mean, you're a physician, you're a pulmonologist, you have a lot of patients of all shapes, sizes, ages, sexes coming through your door. What has been your observation? What have you seen in terms of patients?
So it's generally patients who are uncontrolled. But I mean uncontrolled, someone with high blood pressure that's not controlled, high cholesterol, or diabetics, those are at the highest risk for both a heart attack and for strokes. 99% of people who suffer either a heart attack, or they can have a silent risk factor such as a high blood pressure, high cholesterol, can have a heart attack or a stroke because of these comorbidities. People who use tobacco, people who use vaping, who people are obese, these are all people that are under the constant barrage of being driven by cardiovascular risk due to these risk factors. So high blood pressure, high cholesterol, diabetes. The diabetes damages your blood vessels over time, which doubles your risk of heart failure or heart disease and stroke. The high cholesterol causes buildup of cholesterol in your arteries, that atherosclerosis, which narrows them and makes them blockages more likely. And the high blood pressure, which is your single most modifiable risk factor for a stroke and major cause of heart attacks, is extremely prevalent in causing these types of issues. We also get things like atrial fibrillation, which is an abnormal rhythm, it's irregular heart rhythm, and that significantly increases your risk of stroke. And then other conditions like chronic kidney disease, sleep apnea, even certain autoimmune diseases like rheumatoid arthritis elevate your risk. And if you look at people's demographics, age with age risk increases significantly. For stroke, the risk doubles every 10 years after the age of 55. Men generally have heart attacks earlier in life than women. No surprise there. And however, stroke kills more women than men annually, and 1 in 5 women will experience a stroke.
So and age-wise, I mean, are people, do you see a pattern of people at a certain age, or does this vary? Is this changing?
Definitely is changing. And that's also got to do with genetics and lifestyle. So with genetics, you know, genetics and lifestyle can both significantly impact your risk of a stroke or a heart attack, but lifestyle choices have a great influence on your final outcome. So while you can't change your DNA, healthy habits can reduce your risk of cardiovascular events by about 50%. 50%, even for those with genetic predispositions. So genetics can be about a 20 to 30% influence of overall risk for you to have a heart attack. And these genetics can influence your cholesterol or your blood pressure regulation or your blood clotting regulation. Whereas with lifestyle, 70 to 80% people have an overall risk. So this includes diet, sedentary people, people who don't exercise, smokers, vapors, weight management, and people who imbibe on too much alcohol. And lifestyle offsets your genetic risk. So we're saying that here.
Sorry, just why alcohol?
So alcohol can also cause a hardening of your arteries. It causes increased buildup of your plaque. It can cause tendency towards diabetes. Can cause sclerosis, which is a hardening or a tightening of the vessels. And it can cause your cholesterol to go higher, your bad cholesterol versus your good cholesterol. So moderate alcohol is fine, but excessive alcohol can cause this as well. So the lifestyle can offset your genetic risk. And research shows that DNA is not the destiny regarding this type of disease. So for heart attacks, people who've got the highest genetic risk, who maintain a healthy lifestyle, who don't smoke, who regularly exercise, who aren't obese, have a 45 to 60% lower risk of a coronary event compared to those with the higher genetic risks but poor habits. And for a stroke, it's the same. People have a 40% less chance of having a stroke if they follow correct methods. So genetic interaction, that positive habits can actually turn off certain bad genes or mitigate their effects, such as by improving how the liver clears LDL, which is your bad cholesterol, from your body.
I remember once, and we're not going to say what my result was, but I remember looking at, or you showed me on a blood test, there was a certain marker that indicates if a person is genetically predisposed to heart attack. What is that?
So that's a newer test, which has been around for a number of years, but it's only gained traction in the last number of years. It's called the apolipoprotein B or lipoprotein A.
Which is why I forgot the name.
Yeah. I couldn't believe you can't forget.
I couldn't remember that.
You're not having a stroke now, right?
No. Okay. Smiling.
Yes. Yes. All
right. Yes.
Something else. But it will
right.
Okay. So the apolipoprotein B and the lipoprotein A are much smaller sizes of the cholesterol that can be measured. And those show that if you've got a higher risk propensity for genetic heart disease or...
And is that what you're talking about in terms of turning on or off the genes in a way?
In a way, as well as affecting your LDL, which is your bad cholesterol, and improving your HDL, which is your good cholesterol.
Something that confuses me, and I'd love to hear your thoughts on it, is we were told in the way less days of dieting that obviously we can't have, you could only eat 3 eggs a week because eggs had cholesterol and it was bad for you. Then we were told, no, all nonsense. Animal fat is actually not bad for you. And don't worry about cholesterol. It is so confusing to somebody that follows the literature on this. What is going on with this?
So I think that's a very good point to raise, is because if someone follows literature, it doesn't mean that the literature explains things properly. So you can read something and you see, okay, don't eat eggs, but that's not true. Eggs used to be thought of to be very high cholesterol and blockages. Eggs are very good protein. They're good for you. They don't cause high cholesterol at all. So we don't worry about these things, but what you've got to look at more is the lifestyle and the diet. So the Mediterranean diet, the DASH diet, you know, the low sodium, the low salt. These are more important in your balance and your basis. The small amount of carbohydrates, the low glycemic carbohydrates, where you break down the sugars at a better rate and you don't actually cause a quick drop in your sugar, so you don't get hungry more quickly and you don't have bad sugars in your body. So that's more important with regards to those way less days than eating eggs, which aren't really a problem.
Right. So, but either way, cholesterol is not good for us.
So cholesterol is good for you in moderation.
Oh.
Everyone needs cholesterol in the body to break down certain substrates and enzymes, but a high cholesterol. Now, remember, the cholesterol is broken up into a few subparticles. You get your total cholesterol. You get your high density lipoprotein, which is your HDL, that's your good cholesterol. And you'd preferably like that to be above a level of 1.2, 1.3, even closer to 2, which is great. Okay. Your bad cholesterol, your LDL, you want that to be less than a level of 3. And then we look at, as we say, the apolipoprotein B and the lipoprotein A.
All right, so that does give us a good sense. I want to just ask. I also remember reading somewhere that younger people are now at risk as well. Is that the case?
So that's very pertinent because it's a trend that younger people, and now we define younger people, sorry for you, as those under 50 or even under 40 these days, okay? And they are increasingly at risk for both strokes and heart attacks. So traditionally, these conditions used to be only associated with older age, but there are quite a few factors that drive the shift. So with regards to strokes, the prevalence has risen by about 15 to 20% for people in the age group of 18 to 45 over the last decade. So approximately about 10 to 50% of strokes now occur in adults under the age of 50. And with heart attacks, one in five heart attacks appear in people under the age of 40. And the key risks or the factors for young adults is that there's a presence of modern lifestyle stresses. So your traditional health conditions like high blood pressure, type 2 diabetes, high cholesterol, obesity, these are occurring at much younger ages. Your lifestyle choices, sedentary lifestyles where we get excessive screen watching or time and sitting in front of a TV, poor diets, high in processed foods, and rising rates of vaping and smoking and substance abuse elevate your risks. Mental health, stress, chronic stress, anxiety, depression, these increase and are recognized as contributors to cardiovascular inflammation and high blood pressure. And then interesting emerging risks, such as people who use energy drinks, there's a much higher risk to heart rhythm abnormalities like atrial fibrillation, the opioid epidemic, long-term
Sorry, this
effects.
energy drinks, are you talking about like Red Bull type of?
Well, I'm
I
not
know
naming
you
and
know,
shaming, but when
you're
you talk
not
about
naming and
energy
shaming,
drinks
but I'm
that are
saying
high in all these,
because it's got caffeine, I'm not saying that,
it's
but
got caffeine plus other additives in it, all these taurine,
okay,
caffeine, all these
fine.
things that actually cause a tachycardia, increase in your heart rate, and can dehydrate you further and can cause an atrial fibrillation. But even long-term effects from infections like people who had COVID-19 are contributing factors to cardiac disease. And then once again, even women were younger women who had pregnancy-related complications like preeclampsia. Those are things that people, young women who use hormonal contraception, if they smoke, have higher risks to clots and to strokes. So things are definitely different for younger people.
So something we really do need to be aware of, because we always think of strokes and heart attacks only in the terrain of older people, and that isn't necessarily the case. Right, we are unfortunately running out of time, so I do want to move on to talk about some of the other aspects of it, and just to get an understanding, if somebody wants to reduce the risk of having a stroke or a heart attack starting tomorrow or starting this evening, what are the top three things they should be doing?
So first, don't start tomorrow. Start today. Carpe diem. Okay. Quit smoking. Control your high blood pressure and eat a healthy heart diet. So, smoking is the single most effective change you can make for cardiovascular health. The immediate benefits of stopping smoking: your risk of heart disease drops in as little as one day after quitting tobacco. The long-term impact: after about 1 year of stopping smoking, your risk of heart attack or stroke can drop to about 50% of that of a current smoker.
Wow.
Because smoking thickens the blood and increases plaque buildup in the arteries, both of which accelerate clot formation. The second thing is controlling high blood pressure, because that's the most leading controllable risk factor for stroke, which is associated with 50 to 70% of all strokes. Reducing your salt intake to less than 1.5 grams a day can lower blood pressure in as little as 1 week. Monitoring at home through professionals or through your own blood pressure symptoms. And the target for most adults, and I'm not talking about people with other comorbidities, but most adults is maintaining blood pressure below 120 over 80. And then, of course, adopting a healthy diet, where I said earlier, the Mediterranean or the DASH diet, which is a dietary approach to stopping hypertension. These things can significantly reduce your risk factors. So eating whole grains, lean proteins, fish, beans, poultry, avoids like fats found in your full meats and your full fat dairy, your trans fats, your added sugars. The weight impact, healthy eating helps manage weight, which further reduces the strain on your heart and the risk of conditions like diabetes.
And I know it's a completely different subject, but it isn't actually. Is Do GLP-1s or peptides in of themselves help to reduce the risk of heart attacks or strokes?
So GLP-1s, yes. There's definitely studies that are showing that the Ozempic plus the Mounjaro and even stage two trials for retatrutide, which is
The newer
the
one.
newer one, shows that there's a marked decrease in high blood pressure, in the diabetes, in the plaque buildup for people who are losing weight on them.
But is that because of the weight, or that it does it help in of
In
itself?
of itself, also decreases inflammation in the body. That decreases chronic inflammation that happens.
Okay. And in terms of medication, chronic medication?
So chronic medication is the cornerstone of cardiovascular prevention. It manages your physical conditions and leads to your vascular blockages. So you've got to try and alter the blood flow, stabilize your arterial health within the blood. So in order to prevent blood clots, since most strokes and heart attacks are caused by blood clots which block the blood flow, we use blood thinners. And the most common are the antiplatelet agents like aspirin or something called clopidogrel, which prevent your platelets from sticking together to form a clot. And then other anticoagulants like warfarin or rivaroxaban, which interfere with the chemical process of clotting. So especially for people who've got an irregular heartbeats like atrial fibrillation, that could otherwise cause clots to travel to the brain. You then want to also control the plaque and cholesterol, because a plaque narrows the arteries and can cause sudden rupture. And the important medications are your statins. These are your primary medications to lower your bad LDL cholesterol. And the statins stabilize existing plaque as well, make it less likely for them to break off. And then, of course, you want to reduce the strain on the arteries. So with high blood pressure, which damages the lining of the blood vessels, so your antihypertensives, ACE inhibitors, angiotensin receptor blockers, calcium channel blockers, all these different types of blood pressure medications relax and widen your blood vessels, and it makes it easier for the heart to pump and reduces that hemorrhaging effect of blood against the artery walls, leading to a less chance of clot buildup. And then lastly, diuretics, which are called your water tablets. These help the kidneys remove excess fluid, which lowers your blood pressure and reduces the heart's workload.
How often should somebody have their blood pressure checked? At what different age?
So things have changed now because, as we said, younger people are having strokes, younger people are having heart attacks. So there's no single stroke test for everyone, but cardiovascular screenings are important as early as the age of 18 to 20 years of age now. So the American Heart Association recommends that you should have your blood pressure checked from the age of 18 to 20. And if it's normal, below 120 over 80, then you only have to have it checked every 2 years. Cholesterol, start checking at the age of 20. If it's normal, every 4 to 6 years for normal risk adults. Weight also start at the age of 20. Frequently check it during regular annual checkups. Your blood sugar typically start at the age of 40 to 45. If you've got a high risk factor, start at the age of 35. And then for advanced screening, for people who have got more comorbidities, start from the age of 40. Assess your risk. Assess if you've got a 10-year risk of a heart attack or a stroke. And people need to be checked if they've got, especially people over the age of 65, for what we call abdominal aortic aneurysms, which is a widening of the aorta in the body, which can rupture, especially in people who've smoked. And cardiac calcium scoring in elder people, and recommended in men over the age of 40 or women over the age of 50, to look for plaque buildup if people have got comorbidities and penumbral consequences of these things. So sometimes we say that people should even screen earlier. So if you've got a family history of early heart disease or a stroke, example, a male relative before the age of 55 or a female relative before the age of 65, go earlier, check up earlier. Pre-existence like diabetes, obesity, lifestyle factors like smoking or vaping, be checked out earlier.
And things like aspirin, taking aspirin at home regularly.
So it's not condoned. As I said, there's no benefit to just taking aspirin in case you have a stroke or in case you have a heart attack. Although it can be life-saving in a heart attack, it can be extremely dangerous in certain types of strokes, as well as the fact that it can damage your gut mucosa. So if you've got an ulcer, you can bleed from the ulcer.
Oh God.
So we don't
Yeah, so
offer
just
betting.
don't do it.
It's unless the patient's a high risk for heart disease, and they've got a low risk of bleeding.
Right. Okay. So it really, if there's one thing that I think we need to take away from tonight, it's knowing the signs, acting quickly, not ignoring your body. Anton, a final thought, unless there's something else that you need people to know, what is one thing that you would love every listener to do differently from this minute onwards?
I think it's more of a combination of diet and exercise together. Get those controlled. Start exercising, start eating better, and other things will follow naturally. If you can do that, blood pressure comes down, sugar levels come down, less chance of plaque buildup. Stop smoking, stop vaping. Look out for the things that you can contain and control so that you can live a longer, better life.
And that is all we have time for. This has been your weekly checkup with me, Howard Feldman, and Dr. Anton Marburg. Very excited as well about our next podcast or our next show, because we will be talking about peptides. Dr. Anton Marburg has done, I think, the most incredible amount of research into the field and into the world of peptides. I think that it certainly looks to me like this is going to change the world of medicine, or potentially change many aspects of medicine in the future. So don't forget to listen out for that. We will be chatting about peptides. Thank you for joining us. I'm Howard Feldman. Thanks, Dr. Anton Marburg. This has been your weekly checkup.